Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Wednesday, September 11th, 2019. 18 years ago today, about an hour earlier, 18 years ago, I remember I was getting ready for work, and my wife at the time said, "We've just been attacked." We turned on the TV because her mom had called. We turned on the TV, and we see the buildings on fire. And that was it. We changed forever, I think. Or where were you 18 years ago? Were you in the womb still? Or
I was in Israel. I was sitting on the couch, like a TV couch.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, it pops up in the news. I was like watching whatever, and they just stopped it. And yeah.
Yeah. So it would have been there in the evening because it happened at 8:45 our time. About 8:45 or so, mm-hmm. So if I remember correctly, so it would have been about 6:45 in the evening for you guys.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was very young, so I was like, yeah. What the hell?
Right.
I thought it was a movie. I couldn't believe that this is true. I was like, is this a prank? Something's
not right.
Yeah.
We'd never seen anything like that before, and suddenly. You see all that destruction, and especially New York, you know, the World Trade Center. I mean, what's more American than that, you know?
Yeah.
And so we were attacked, in our heart, really. And things have never been the same. So from what I recall, over 3,000 people have died. And wow. That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
That were stuck in burning rooms and offices and whatever. I don't even want to imagine what they had to go through.
Yeah.
You know, the people jumping out of the windows and stuff. So that's pretty desperate.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the show, everybody. In a few minutes, we're joined by a guest today, and we're going to talk about a lot of different things, mostly China, because he's an expert on China. And I think everybody's fascinated by China because we don't really know it as much as we think we know China.
We don't know
it's China.
It's so different.
Right? So we're going to hear firsthand and talk about his book and everything. So that'll be cool in just a moment. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah?
I'm good.
Did you sleep good last night?
Yeah. We did a show.
Oh, you did a show last night? Where?
Yeah, it's a place in Hollywood called Station 16, something like that. Station okay. Something. It's uh-huh. It's a club turn.
You don't even know where you went to perform. I don't know.
It was in Hollywood, like 4 minute walk from my house. So I just walked there, and it was good. It was fun.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How many comedians were there?
Five.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds good, Miss Comedian here.
I have a good time, you know.
I'm sure you do. I mean, that's why you invest a lot of time and effort into it.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How
was my what? I work. Nothing's going on in my life, you know. It's crazy, but I've been watching. I don't watch movies in one sitting, so. I've been watching It, the first one, again.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah.
I don't watch scary stuff. I don't like scary stuff.
Yeah. The only reason I did watch it and will watch the new one is because it's based on a Stephen King book,
yeah.
Which I had read, and it happened to be one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But for me, it wasn't the scary part so much as the relationship between the characters. And you must understand, in the book, they go back and forth chronologically from when they're kids to when they're adults, and they come back to town, and that's what the second chapter is about in the movie.
Yeah.
As adult, they're coming back to fight the monster and
uh-huh.
stuff. But in the movies, they divided it into two, and that's why in the first one I was watching, I'm like, where are they when they're grown? You know, it's
yeah.
part of the story.
Yeah.
But and then the first movie ended with It Chapter One. So you knew so then there's like, another okay, one coming.
There's
you
another
know?
One coming. Right. I appreciate thrillers and, yeah, and, yeah. And horror. I really, really, really appreciate. I have to go with somebody.
I know. I mean, horror movies are not my,
I can't watch
my
them
favorite
alone.
Genre, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But some of them are good, you know?
No,
you
I appreciate them. I like them. I usually, if I watch a horror, it'll be in the day, in the middle of the day.
Right, and you need somebody there with you to protect you.
And I can just go and there's something. I don't have to like go to sleep with these thoughts. But I really appreciate that.
Yeah, cool. I just wanted to bring up this thing with the lung-related disease from vaping.
Oh, really? I heard about that. So what's going on?
Apparently, people that use those pens, those vaporizers,
right?
Instead, like they call them e-cigarettes or
yeah,
e-vape
Juuls.
Or something, right? So the Juuls are like the the brand of some of them.
Yeah,
but people smoke a lot of different stuff too.
Yeah.
Or vape,
yeah,
whatever,
I just see
including cannabis too. So they don't know if it's because of anything, but I'm willing to bet you that the way they get that cannabis oil is through such chemical processes. They put all kinds of chemicals in it and stuff, and so who knows what they put in there, and you inhale it, into
yeah.
your lungs.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised, but
Is it the popcorn lungs? I'm sorry.
I think that's what they used to refer to, probably. And now that's what's happening.
Let
so
me tell you something.
I'm staying away from that.
I smoked these Juuls
uh-huh.
for a few months because I was trying to get off cigarettes. And I was like, oh, it's not as stinky. It might get me off. First of all, these are much worse because the nicotines in them are more.
Really?
I felt,
biggest
and then I
concentration, so you got high from it or what?
No, the nicotine. So
right.
You don't get off the nicotine.
Right.
So you're still addicted.
Right.
And there's more. Mm. And then I think after 3 or 4 months, I started feeling a sharp pain in my lung. And I was like, you know what? This is not good.
Yeah.
I'm not going to touch these. And yeah, I went back to cigarettes, which is not good. I need to stop altogether.
Yeah, but maybe cigarettes are better than these popcorn lungs.
You're saying makes sense is what, from my experience. Yeah, so what is happening to these people? How do they figure it out?
Well, I don't know. They're still investigating really what's causing it. They don't know. It's just assumptions.
Shoot.
You know, they're trying to find some kind of like cause and all that, but they're not sure yet.
Yeah.
So that's that. And yeah.
And people who smoke vapes smoke a lot because
right.
there's also the dangers of it. Like a cigarette is not in the consciousness yet. It's like, oh, it's a vape. It's
yeah,
a vape.
It's
so
safe.
People smoke it all the time. And you shouldn't smoke anything. Like
no.
Doesn't matter what it is. You shouldn't consume it that much.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Well.
Some of us are stuck. Anyway, we're going to bring in our guest right now who's waiting patiently. And I didn't bring up my notes here. Let me see that for a moment because I don't want to be, I don't want to miss a point with our interview. Usually I don't look at notes or anything, but I just wanted a little background on you. But we're going to find everything firsthand from you. So we're joined by Mr. Frank Heller. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We were talking a little bit earlier about you traveling. You were in Israel for a week. Did you travel anywhere else during that trip?
From Israel, we went to Croatia.
Ah.
And we spent a little time there.
What attracted you to Croatia?
Absolutely nothing. It was my wife's idea. Uh-huh. And we traveled with another couple. So the two women got together and they said, okay, well, we've been here and here and here. Let's find some place we've never been to.
Right.
So we hit Dubrovnik and Split.
Uh-huh.
And there's a small island called Ivar, H-V-A-R.
Okay.
You take a hydrofoil from Split and you go to Ivar. And we had a fabulous meal. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Wow.
But if you're not into scuba diving, water skiing, eating incredible meals, or sitting on a yacht, there's not too much to do.
Isn't that the place for you? Huh?
No. And from there, we went on to Italy.
Very nice. Where in Italy did you go?
Started out in Venice, and then rented a car, drove up to Lake Como.
Uh-huh. Wow, what a trip, man. Nice.
Well, it went on from there.
Yeah.
We had seen Andreas Bocelli here at the Hollywood Bowl. and he performed with his son. It was an incredible concert. My wife was looking up when Bocelli was going to be performing here again, because we have four granddaughters. So the idea was we wanted to take the granddaughters. She found out that Bocelli was going to be performing in Sicily at a place called Taormina, which is an incredible city on top of a mountain, and the next mountain over is Mount Etna. So she managed to get tickets to a sold-out concert.
Oh, wow, that's nice.
Then she managed to get a hotel room in the Grand Hotel Tamayo.
Oh, wow.
Which is right on top of the mountain. And got the last room in the entire hotel.
Wow. So you guys get lucky with that.
Well, not only that, but he's performing in a Greek amphitheater that's 2,500 years old.
Oh, wow.
How cool is that?
So the view is you're sitting in the amphitheater, there's the stage, and beyond the stage, beyond the ruins, the entire coastline of Sicily.
Unbelievable.
Later, before I leave, I'll show you some video that we took on my cell phone.
Yeah. So it's amazing because these are places like at least Croatia that's not really on the wish list for many people to go to see, but you ended up there and you saw places you probably would never dream you'd see.
No, you step in Dubrovnik, you step back into the 12th century to visit the old city, and it's beautiful.
Wow.
The people are incredible,
and
the price is right. The exchange rate is very good in our favor.
Good. That's the way to travel. When your money's worth more.
Yeah.
True. Had you traveled before to other places? Where else have you been? I mean, well, China, and we're going to talk about that. But I also understand you were in the military in Vietnam?
Did you participate in the U.S. Navy. I was a hospital corpsman.
Oh.
And stationed on board an aircraft carrier.
Oh, wow.
Which was very lucky for me. The funny story is that when I enlisted in the Navy, it was with a guarantee of going to hospital corps school. In boot camp, they give you a series of exams. They give you all the inoculations that you need so that you're good and sick by the time that you take your placement exams. Uh-huh. And when you're running 102 fever, then they give you the tests. When they evaluate the tests, they came to me and said, okay, you're going to make a great radio operator, an electrician, or a machinist mate. And I said, yes, but I have a contract that says I'm guaranteed hospital corps school. They took the contract. They turned it over. You see this line here? It says, for the good of the service, we can put you any damn place with police.
that sounds like Army.
Well, no, this was Navy.
It's
much better.
Military.
Anyway, bottom line was that I got hospital corps school. Mm. And the first class that we took, you know, the U.S. Marines have no medical personnel. Every time you see a movie and the Marine gets wounded and he yells, Corpsman, it's a Navy corpsman that comes running.
I see.
So our first class, the instructor said, if you go to the Marines and you're involved in a landing assault, your life expectancy is 7 seconds. Because they want to put the corpsman out of commission. The theory being that the corpsman will put wounded combat soldiers back into the fight.
So you're like the central place where if they just take this out, everything else is affected as well.
You're the target.
Yeah. Wow.
So my first weekend of liberty, I'm 17 years old.
Right.
And considerably stupider than I am now.
Weren't we all?
I came home on liberty, and I'm telling my mother this story. 7 second life expectancy. And my mother, being a survivor of the Holocaust, she survived in hiding in Budapest. She said, there's no problem. There's no war. Mm. 6 months later, I'm on board an aircraft carrier and the Gulf of Tonkin incident happens and I'm in a war.
Wow. See, it must have affected her quite a bit.
She worried a lot.
Yeah, I don't blame her. So you really went into the danger zone, front lines. How long were you there for?
In Vietnam?
In Vietnam.
Two tours, 22 months.
Oh, wow.
But here again, I was extremely lucky. I was on board a ship. The corpsman from my class who went with the Marines, they were in direct combat. and two-thirds of them didn't make it back.
Wow. Wow.
So I was very, very
yeah,
lucky.
You were spared. I mean, because you had in your life the ability to save other people's lives, you know? That's an amazing thing.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. So you got memories, obviously. I mean, I know everybody I talked to that had been to the war, they've seen things they don't want to talk about
they
or
don't
even
talk about.
Think about. War is hell.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Being in the Navy, being overseas, being 17, 18 years old, also had a lot of fun to it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
We did a lot of crazy things.
Hold a gun and all that stuff.
Well, no. Geneva Convention says a corpsman can only carry a sidearm.
Okay.
So when I was going to fly Air Sea Rescue, they gave me a sidearm. The Marines handed me a Colt 45 semi-automatic pistol.
And that's what you had to defend yourself with?
Yes.
That's not enough.
No.
No, I gave it back.
Okay, yeah. I was like, that's not enough.
And when we were in Japan, I went to the PX and I bought a single action 357 Magnum revolver. Theory being that a single action revolver can get dirty and muddy and it'll still work.
Yeah, it won't jam.
No.
Wow. So you learned quite a bit how to survive down there.
Learn fast.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to.
You really do.
You
know?
don't have a choice.
Yeah. Where did you grow up? Where were you born?
I was born in Bucharest, Romania.
Ah.
My mother and father fled Budapest on one side when the Russians came in on the other. She was pregnant with me. We got as far as Bucharest. And the war ended in May. I was born in June.
Of 45?
45.
Wow. What a time to be born.
It was a great time to be born.
Yeah. Wow. But, I mean, very historic, obviously, you know, and at the end of the war is obviously better than before.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, my wife and I are only children of Holocaust survivors. My father-in-law survived 13 concentration camps.
Oh, wow. That is insane.
Yeah. Somebody was guarding over him. For
yeah.
Sure.
Well, he learned very quickly if he was useful, then they would keep him alive. So there was a group of them. Anytime somebody said, we need somebody who knows how to do electrical work. His hand went up. Oh, I'm an electrician.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If they needed a carpenter, he was a carpenter. If they needed somebody to lay brick, he was a stonemason.
Wow.
Jeez.
That's how they don't kill you.
Yeah.
If you're useful, they kept you.
And you know what? These are great lessons, like, for life, for work, for career, you know? I mean, if you don't, like, if you don't make yourself, like, available and valuable, you can be replaced. But you're right, you know?
Not only that, you have to recognize opportunities when they arise.
Yeah.
And that's critical. Anyway, but to answer your question, I grew up here in L.A., in West Los Angeles.
I see. Oh, so they migrated to America when, your parents?
We arrived, my mother and father split up when we were in Paris, mm-hmm. When I was a year and a half old. And then my mother came into the United States as a war bride. We came to Los Angeles and spent 6 months on a visitor's visa here in Los Angeles with my grandparents. Then went to Mexico City, spent 6 months there. My mother came in as a war bride, and my mother's brother, who was in the Army Air Corps, brought me across the border at Calexico in a U.S. Army staff car. He was in his full captain's uniform, and standing on the seat next to him, because at that time you didn't believe in seatbelts for kids, he had a box of cookies on the seat. As we passed by the border, I waved at the border guard and said, "Hasta luego, señor," which made my uncle extremely upset.
Really?
But that was illegal immigration on my part.
Yeah.
I don't know why I felt compelled to say that, but
no, that's okay, because maybe you have strong feelings about what's going on now in the country, but. We'll try to leave politics out of it for now. Okay. We'll get to it when we get to China, I'm sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, very cool. So, well, now we know a little bit of background about you. What do you, what have you done in your life before you were writing? What is your, did you choose a career, a profession?
I'm on my fifth incarnation with this book. So I'm on my fifth life. The way that I started out in China, obviously, was in the U.S. Navy.
Mm.
My first visit to Hong Kong was in 64, which was enormously eye-opening. The wealth disparity between the very, very rich in Hong Kong in 64 and the very, very poor was an eye-opener. There were 750,000 illegal immigrants in Hong Kong living in shanties in the New Territories. And when I say shanties, these were shelters that were built from thrown away material, cardboard, pieces of wood, anything they could scrounge together and put together. Those 750,000 people were refugees from Southeast Asia, some from China, and they were just looking for a place to stay and stay alive.
Right.
Unfortunately, some years later, and I mentioned this in the book, there was a typhoon that hit Hong Kong, and the worst of it was in the New Territories. So it wiped out all of those shanties and destroyed, I don't know how many thousands of people.
Right. It seems like those storms always go after the the poor areas, you know, because it's, well, because they're usually around the tropics and stuff, you know, where all the hurricanes and things happen.
Yeah.
But you look at Jamaica now, I mean, the stuff wasn't built very well, you know.
But those are the most vulnerable.
Right.
The people who have money can afford to build the code.
Right.
And use strong materials and build a structure that's going to withstand that.
That's true. That's true. But
anyway, to answer your initial question,
right?
When I went to work for my father-in-law in his import business, we began manufacturing builders and cabinet hardware in mainland China. That was 40 years ago. So our hinge factories would call up and say, "I'm sorry, we can't deliver your order on time. There's going to be a slight delay." Why? We ran out of our allotment of electricity.
Mm.
No.
Oh, wow.
When you think about that for a moment, think of an American factory that runs out of electricity.
Right.
It's mind-boggling.
It is.
And
it doesn't happen very often.
In between those instances, they would complain that the electrical wires and the phone wires had been cut because people would steal the copper to sell on the black market.
Oh, yeah. Jeez. I heard about that.
I know, me too. That was some time ago, though, right?
That was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Then China instituted what's known as the Free Economic Zone along the eastern seaboard of the country. That allowed for the first time since the revolution, private ownership of business, of property, and private money, which was key.
Yeah.
Now you have millionaires and billionaires along that eastern seaboard. And there is a huge burgeoning economy there, which is a market economy. It's very much like ours, with certain exceptions.
Right.
But that's key. That's key to their development.
Right. So you saw China develop, obviously, since the 60s, and now we're 2019. You've seen it go through a lot.
Yes.
A lot of changes in China over the years. I mean, Hong Kong. So Hong Kong at the time was still British when you were there?
Yes.
Okay, so it wasn't Chinese. I mean, it was had been Chinese, but the British got it, right?
Well, the British got it kind of in a very negative way. In the book, I make the comment that the British are responsible for creating the illicit use of drugs.
Mm.
China had been selling huge amounts of tea and porcelain. Chinese export ware at that time to the British Empire, which was very vast. And Britain said, you know, we're paying you in silver. How about we do 50% silver and 50% opium? Because we have these colonies and their primary product is opium.
Right.
And China said, you're crazy. We're not taking opium. And Great Britain said, okay. And the British East India Company began smuggling opium into China.
Into China, wow.
Wow.
And China said, you got to cut this out. And they said, no.
You got to make us all high in here, you know.
No, they went to war.
Really?
That was the first opium war.
Right.
1842.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
So China went to war to stop drug trafficking coming into their country.
Right.
They're very serious about that kind of stuff.
Oh, more so now than they were then.
Yeah. Right. Is it true that you get if you get caught in China smoking weed or something like that, I heard all kinds of stories.
Probably go to jail, but I mean, it used to be here pretty recently,
too. I've heard harsher stories.
Yeah, right.
I think we've all heard harsher stories. And it's not something I want to find out for sure.
Yeah.
So tell me something. When you first got a taste of China, did you have this desire to learn more about it, to be associated with it?
I'm a history nut. So I began looking into the history of China and how China related to the Western world and the things that happened. I don't know if you remember, years ago there was a movie called 55 Days at Peking, which chronicled the Boxer Rebellion in China, which was a rebellion to throw out the Westerners.
I see.
That, like the Opium Wars, didn't work out
too well
for China.
And when did that happen?
That was, I think, the Boxer Rebellion ended in 1909.
I see. So it's pretty recent, relatively speaking.
Relatively. But right. The net result of the Boxer Rebellion was that the Western nations, the eight nations, put a fine on China that was equal to 40% of their GDP at that time. Mm-hmm. And the only country that felt badly about taking all that money out of their economy was the United States. Mm-hmm. So President Teddy Roosevelt said, you know what, we're going to give you back $11 million in change, and we want you to build a university in Beijing, which they did. And that university still stands today, and it's the largest university in the country.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Wow. How much did it cost them to put it together at the time? Do you know?
I have no idea. But they had $11 million in 1910.
Oh, 11 That's million. A lot. Yeah.
Was like hundreds of billions today.
Really? That much? Wow.
So,
jeez. So, yeah,
I want to come back, though, because you asked me a question about how Britain got Hong Kong.
Right.
That was the second Opium War. Mm. China went to war again with Great Britain because of the opium trade, and they lost that one, too. And that's when Great Britain took Hong Kong and Kowloon. Later on, they got the new territories as well.
Yeah.
And they also forced China to open up trade in other parts of the country. And that's how Shanghai became an international city.
Wow. So the British were pretty strong at the time.
The line was, the sun never sets on the British Empire.
Right. And it did, actually, right?
It didn't. The British Empire was around the world.
Right. No, I'm saying now, you know. Now's
a different story.
Right. That's what I mean. Wow. So, okay, so now you were, so when did you take your first trip to China?
First trip to China was probably 82,
so
thereabouts. And I was working with my father-in-law in the hardware business, and we used to go to the Canton Fair. Mm-hmm. The Canton Fair is, they call it the Chinese International Import-Export Fair. Mm-hmm. So they exhibited anything that is grown, manufactured, mined out of the ground, assembled in China, they exhibit at this fair. And people from all over the world come to buy or to make manufacturing contracts. First time I went, it was seven small buildings in downtown Canton, Guangzhou. Today, it is one building, over 1 million square feet under roof. That's the difference.
That's, wow. Yeah. It's pretty interesting, you know. So, I mean, what appeal did you have? I mean, I'm trying to find, like, what fascinated you about China? Why did you want to, like, pursue going there? And is it the culture? Did you feel some kind of connection to the culture?
Probably I did, but it was the fascination of the history.
I see.
And I was there anyway for business.
Right.
So you can't work 24/7. You take a little side trip.
Exactly.
You visit the Forbidden City.
Right.
And first time I was in the Forbidden City, there's the Hall of Harmony, which is the throne room. And you stand in front of the Imperial Dragon Throne in this magnificent building. Ceiling is 40 feet high. And this throne sits on a dais that's about 10, 12 feet off the floor.
Mm.
The carvings are incredibly intricate and gilded with gold and silver. And you wonder, what if? What if the last emperor of China, Puyi, wasn't the last emperor? In the movie, The Last Emperor, they show the empress being pregnant and giving birth to a child that dies in birth.
Mm-hmm.
What if that wasn't the case?
Mm.
What if the last emperor had a child?
Mm.
What could have happened? What story could have come from that?
Right.
And that's how I came up with the story of the Sacred Empress.
Wow, wow. Very cool. So we're going to go into, dig into the book a little bit. The book is called The Sacred Empress. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Frank Heller, an L.A. born.
No.
No?
Bucharest born, L.A.
Oh, I'm
raised.
Sorry, L.A. raised. That's what I meant. How could I forget the Bucharest part? But how old were you when you came?
When we finally moved to Los Angeles, I was 3.
You were 3. Okay, so you're L.A. You know, I mean, it's like, just like my dad was born in Greece, and then when he was about a year, 2 years old, they immigrated to Israel, you know, mm-hmm. So it's not like he really knows Greek or anything, and he doesn't say I'm Greek, you know, but because when you're a kid, you're a kid, you know, but
yeah.
But you have a passport for, you can go to the EU, no problem, right?
I did, yes.
Pretty cool. All right, so the idea for the Sacred Empress came to you, and so you said you've worked on it for quite a while. Had you written anything before that?
I've written quite a bit. I was in the art business for many years. I had a gallery in Beverly Hills. So I've got about 5 or 6 things in the Smithsonian Library, mostly artist biographies, exhibition catalogs.
Mm.
This is my first work of fiction, but The Sacred Empress has an interesting genesis. I wrote it as a 5-page treatment for a movie 18 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I sold it to a film company who promptly did absolutely nothing with it.
Yeah, like, oh, so many.
I know, that never happens to a writer. after 2 years, the rights came back to me. I pulled it out 4.5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and turned those 5 pages into 65 pages, gave it to a very, very nice literary agent here in town by the name of Mike Hamelberg, who loved it and said, okay, now write the novel.
Mm.
And, you know, I mentioned before, I have 4 granddaughters.
Yes.
It's very difficult to get a novel going when you sit down to the computer and somebody climbs up in your lap and says, Poppy, can we look at pictures on the computer?
Yeah, there you go. Play games.
It slows down your writing.
It does. Huh?
So it took me a little over 4 years to finish the novel.
Right.
In the meantime, Mike Hamelberg passed away. So that made it a little more difficult.
Yes.
Yeah. But you managed to do it, obviously.
I did, yes.
Okay, yeah. So he passed away. You finished the novel. Now you have a novel in your hands.
I have a manuscript.
No agent.
No agent. And lots of contacts in this town who were very, very nice and said, eh. So I wound up self-publishing.
So, very nice. So that's the thing, though. I mean, with every creative thing you do, especially with writing, it's like you spend so much time in it. For people to, in the end, just go, meh, you know, and it's like you go, what the hell, you know? I mean, there's gotta be more to it than, you know. I mean, I'm not just imagining things. It's my book is a good book, you know. So you have to deal with a lot of rejection, obviously. But finally, you say, forget about it. I'm going to publish it anyway. You do self-publishing.
I did self-publishing. I was surprised to find out that the number of self-published books in this country is huge.
Yeah.
And I also did a book signing at Barnes & Noble on August 5th, which was very, very enjoyable.
It was,
I'm trying to think of the right word, a writer who can't think of a word, right? I was terrified that I was going to do this book signing at Barnes & Noble at the Grove, and nobody would show up.
That's the biggest fear.
We had an overflow crowd of 102 people. They ran out of chairs.
Oh, wow.
They sold out all the hardcovers.
Really?
And almost all of the softcovers.
That's nice.
So that was terrific for the ego.
Yes. Yes. Finally, you get some recognition after all the mans you were getting... somewhere else.
I got to tell you another story. You know, being a grandfather, this comes with the territory. You notice the cover of the book. There is this incredible imperial dragon.
Mm.
By the way, you can always tell an imperial dragon in China.
Really?
Because it has five claws.
Oh, I see. Here, take a look at the picture. Only imperial dragons
are allowed five claws.
Really?
Wow. Any other dragon that it's not for the imperial family has to have four.
Ah, so now the dragons were like, they belong to families?
No, the dragon is the symbol of the emperor.
Okay. So how come there's different dragons?
Well, because if you're part of the imperial family, you can do five claws.
Okay. No, I understand that, but why? Do you know why?
No, I don't, actually.
Maybe because it's like five fingers like human being, and, you know, and the only, I guess the only dragon that would seem like a human being would be the imperial one.
Maybe.
That's interesting, right? We don't think about these things.
Well, there's something a little bit more to it.
Right.
The emperor is the one who rules everything on earth. The gods rule everything above earth. So the emperor is referred to as the son of heaven. The imperial guard... which you've heard all about the terracotta warriors.
I haven't, no.
Oh, this was the tomb of the first emperor of China, mm-hmm. who, when he was creating his tomb, he wanted a representation of his imperial guard to protect him. So they created these terracotta images of his guard. So far, they've uncovered something like 7,000.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And these are clay figures that are exact replicas of members of the guard.
Wow.
No two faces are alike. Every face of every soldier is unique.
Mm.
So the Imperial Guard was referred to as the Dragon's Claw. If the Emperor is the power, the Dragon's Claw implements that power.
I see. Okay. So there's a legend behind all this, right?
It makes sense, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an amazing system for people to, I guess when you're born into that kind of a governance or whatever, it just, you take it as it is. You don't question it or anything. But how does it work? I mean, this involves a lot of ancient culture for them, right?
It does.
Yeah, a lot of... is it like a religion almost, the way they treat this? Like with the dragons and the emperor and all that stuff?
Yeah, to a very great degree.
Yeah.
More so than before the advent of Western culture and the Communist Revolution.
Right.
Anyway, the point that I was making about the cover.
Yes.
Originally, I was going to put the image of the imperial throne on it. Right. And my oldest granddaughter, her name is Gemma, she's now 10, she looked at the mock-up of the cover, and she said, why do you want to put an old chair on the cover of your book? It's all about the dragon's claw. Put a dragon on the cover of the book.
Yeah.
Now you see.
There you go.
The net result of my granddaughter.
It makes sense.
Very cool. I like that, man. You know, a joint effort by a grandpa and his grandchild.
Sometimes kids know best.
Yeah, because of their
innocence, they just get straight to the point. Well, why won't you put the dragon? You know, it's
because we think too much.
We think too much as adults. You're like, you know what? Right. That actually does make sense.
It worked out.
Yeah, very cool. So, tell us a little bit about the plot of the book. What goes on in the book, and why should people pick it up?
The hero in this story is a man named Joe Wilder. Who, in addition to everything else, he was at one time a covert CIA operative during his time as an international bodybuilder. So he was a competitor. He won 7 Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia titles. And one day he was, this is part of the underlying history and the impetus for the things that he did later on in the story.
Right.
He was in Paris. He went to a department store to do some shopping. And he walks into a terror attack where 5 terrorists have taken a group of school children hostage. And being the hero that he is, he manages to dispatch 4 of the 5 terrorists and save all but 1 of the children. And the memory of that lone dead child being held in his arms haunts him for the rest of his life. He quits the CIA. He establishes a private company, and he creates a huge conglomerate that manufactures and distributes bodybuilding equipment, has gymnasiums around the world, manufactures health food supplements, most of which he does in China, and he publishes 7 magazines, and he turns it into a billion-dollar enterprise. Excuse me. All of a sudden, he's hit with a new contract because his contracts are coming up for renewal. And his Chinese suppliers hit him with a 30% price increase mm-hmm. in his costs.
Right.
No company can sustain that.
Right.
So he goes to the Canton Fair to renegotiate his deals with the deputy minister of trade responsible for his factories. She says, I'll give you a new contract, give you a sweetheart deal. I want a favor in return. I have a child, 12 years old. Help my child get to America.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
And he says, okay. And the next morning he finds out that that deputy minister has been murdered.
Wow.
He is now the prime suspect in her murder. He is also the only person responsible for this 12-year-old.
Yeah.
And he's being hunted by the largest criminal organization in China with tentacles that date back to the first Opium War.
How would you like that aura?
Wow.
And the story takes you on a race. He's got 4 days to get this child to safety.
Yeah, to raise the stakes. You got to raise them a little bit higher even.
And so you wind up running halfway across China and back again.
Wow.
Very cool. How many have you traveled in China quite a bit?
Fairly.
Within the country?
Fairly, yeah. It's a huge country.
I think it has to be huge to hold that population. It's unbelievable, right?
I mean, 1.3 billion people.
1.3 billion, wow. That's why they're so powerful in everything they do, you know, because they get the people power, right?
No.
They can overrun everybody, no?
No, it's not people. They're very smart about what they're doing. Now we're going to get into politics.
Okay. we only have a few minutes. That's a good thing.
I'll make it short.
No, that's okay. Yeah, that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. The short answer is that in the United States, businessmen, companies, conglomerates plan 2, 3, 4, 5 years, maybe 10 years down the road. China is planning 100 years, 150 years down the road.
Mm.
My wife and I went on a tour in Africa in November of last year. Went to a country called Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is an extremely poor country. China lent them billions and billions of dollars and took as collateral their natural resources, their railway system, their power grid, and their airports. What makes anybody think that Zimbabwe is going to be able to repay those loans?
Right.
China has taken over the control and construction of seaports around the world. I've lost track as to how many. But they're doing this very methodically. If they can't control manufacture, which they're not being able to control now,
right,
thanks to the resurgence of our country and our manufacturing, they want to control the flow of product. If they control the seaports, they control that flow of product.
Yeah.
Smart.
Smart is not, it doesn't even begin to describe this. So, yeah, so obviously, I mean, you know, like the insides of it that we don't really know, right? But the thing is, like, do they really have like these big plans to, excuse me, for example, like the president describes how they manipulate their money, right? To make
the currency exchange.
The currency, right.
Absolutely.
So they do that, right?
Of course.
And
that's
unfair trade.
Look, let's come back to when I was in the Navy.
Okay.
In 1964, I made my first stop in Japan. At that time, the Japanese yen was fixed in exchange to the dollar at 360 to 1.
Right.
There was no floating currency then. So Japanese products for Americans were extremely affordable.
Right.
And that's when you started seeing huge influx of Japanese transistor radios, stereos, tape decks.
Right. TVs.
Automobiles.
Yeah.
Not even TVs at that point. This is 64.
Well, TVs were around 64.
They were around, but the biggest manufacturer of TVs was here.
Yeah, RCA or...
Exactly.
It was. Yeah, okay.
But that slowly changed.
Right.
No, not slowly. That quickly changed because of the rate of exchange of dollar to yen.
I see. Okay.
When it's fixed,
uh-huh,
they have control. We don't. Mm. The Chinese currency, the yuan, was fixed at 8 to 1. When they were forced to allow that to float, they manipulated the float to make sure that it stayed 8 to 1.
Yeah. So they're not stupid. That's the bottom line, right? Chinese are not stupid, and they're actually a lot smarter than we thought.
There's a scene in the book,
right,
where Joe Wilder is in a shop and he's negotiating to buy a Tang horse.
Okay.
A ceramic horse. And he's arguing back and forth, negotiating with the shopkeeper. And he finally finds the line that we have been in the marketplace for over 3,000 years.
Yeah.
We're new to Western methods, but we're not new to the bazaar.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, China's got a long history, you know, just that... I think it's still mysterious to us here on the West, in the West, you know. And
it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. Because number one, it's fascinating.
Right.
And there is so much that has influenced the Western world,
right,
that China has done.
Right.
The difference between China 3,000 years ago and today is that China 3,000 years ago was very innovative.
Right. And today?
Today, they copy.
Right.
They don't innovate.
Right. Well, that's what the Japanese did too, right? I mean, they copied.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where everybody copies America. I mean, this is where innovation happens. Listen, we only have a couple minutes left. Let's promote the book again. It's called The Secret Empress. Is this available like everywhere?
It's available on Amazon. You can go into your local Barnes & Noble. They can order it for you.
Cool.
There are about 4 or 5 other sites on the web where you can order the book.
Awesome. And it's Frank Heller.
Actually, Frank R. Heller, because if they
Frank
look
at, R.
if
okay.
they look it up online and they don't put in the middle initial, they'll get another writer who died in 1922.
Oh, no. God help us, no. You hadn't been born yet.
Not then, no.
No. The last question I wanted to ask you then, should we consider China a friend or an adversary?
Yes.
Both?
Absolutely.
Wow. Hmm. So it's important one way or another, right?
It's extremely important, much more so than the Soviet Union was.
Right.
When it was in its heyday, because it's a very different kind of adversary to deal with.
Right, like more economic, right?
Yes, and more subtle. As I said,
yeah,
they're planning 100 years out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be very interesting to see what comes within the next few weeks in the trade talks. And my personal opinion, for what it's worth, and it's not worth much, is...
Here it makes some difference.
I think that there will be a trade deal that will be negotiated.
Well, I guess because they have to, right? I mean, there's no way around it. We have to agree on something. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and on that note, folks, now we know more about China than we did an hour ago.
A lot more. Which is cool,
right?
A lot more.
Yeah, you see,
that's why it's
worth listening to the show. You learn something new every day. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Do you have any presence online if people want to contact you?
The website is www.thesecretempress.com.
Simple enough to me.
Yeah.
I'm going to dig into this book, and like you said, it's an easy read. It's not very thick, so I have time for that.
It's a good weekender or a plane flight.
Plane flight or something like that.
It works out great.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Or thank you, as always.
Thank you for having me again, Sam.
Of course. What do you mean, having you? You live here now.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Thank you all. And don't forget, it's 9/11. We gotta remember and never forget. And we'll see you all tomorrow.
Listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.